Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, we'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on our program today, Comrades 2025, big run, bigger money, but who really cashes in? The marathon is also one of the world's largest mass casualty rolling logistics exercises. I'll take you inside the emergency tent. Business confidence blinks red as trade tensions and politics weigh heavy, and airlines stay airborne in 2025, but the headwinds are gathering. It's Thursday, the 5th of June. Business confidence in South Africa has taken another knock. According to the very latest RMB BER Business Confidence Index, sentiment among business leaders dropping to 40 in the second quarter. That's down from 45 in Q1. The fall reflecting deepening concerns over South Africa's strained trade ties with the United States, obviously ongoing logistical nightmares, and a degree of domestic political uncertainty. So wholesale trade was the only bright spot, while construction, manufacturing and motor dealing all slumping. I'm in conversation now with Kebetswe Mojapelo, macroeconomist at RMB. Let's take a look at the findings and maybe what they signal for South Africa's broader economic outlook. Kebetswe, welcome and thank you very much indeed. So the index is down despite a recovery in equity markets. So my question to you, doesn't that suggest maybe that the business sector is reacting more to sentiment than to fundamentals?
Yes. So Jeremy, you're quite right. I mean, business does react to sentiment. If you go to the teachings of John Maynard Keynes, we talk about animal spirits. It's not only fundamentals really that drive activity in the economy. It's sentiments. It's how people feel about business conditions. And what this current survey is saying is that we're looking at a picture where there's a lot of uncertainty. We haven't really fixed a lot of our structural impediments. And so very difficult for them to look at the current business conditions as being conducive to really lift up operations and put more money in investment. And you saw with the GDP number as well, private investment came about minus 4.5% quarter on quarter. This really reflected the uncertainty in the environment that we've been in. And you see it in consumers as well. When there's high uncertainty, people are reluctant to actually do spending, to actually increase their investment. And there's a pullback in all agents, business and consumers.
Let me push you a little bit on logistics, which is a key issue. But we also know the problems at Transnet have been ongoing for years now. Surely at this stage, business would have already adapted and factored that in.
I mean, business is trying to adapt. If you look at freight transportation in the country, the last StatsSA data showed that almost 82% of freight payload is by road and the rest is rail. So you're seeing this investment in road infrastructure, so basically trucks. But at the same time, there are some goods, or rather some minerals as well, that cannot really be taken by road. And even in the past, it has always been dependent on rail, some manufacturing input goods that should be taken directly from the ports to the manufacturing plants using rail. So those are also slowing down their momentum. And although Transnet is doing a lot of work, I mean, just this morning, they announced that they had a very successful RFI and around 11,000 site visits, portal site visits, were experienced from Transnet, with private sector trying to really get into this government initiative to introduce a lot of these PPP projects to try and circumvent this project. So This comes from hot of the heels of Operation Vulindlela Phase 2.
How do you interpret the fact that retail and motor trade confidence has dropped despite relatively healthy consumer indicators? Is this maybe a deeper warning about household resilience?
Exactly. You're quite right. Look at consumers were really the engine that we thought would propel growth this year. The tailwinds were there getting into 2025. We had the two-pot injection. We envisaged 3 interest rate cuts, inflation remaining muted. And if you look at all those factors, now what we're seeing is we had a pause in monetary policy cuts. We're looking at an uncertain July monetary policy meeting, likely to still get another cut in the second half. But then you look at the other stuff. Two-pot, we're not going to see the $43 billion that we saw in the fourth quarter last year, roughly around $10 billion for the whole year. And if you look at the only supportive thing is inflation, it does provide that buying power advantage for consumers. But at the moment, they are also uncertain. People will not be making purchases of durable goods, your vehicles, your housing, if they don't know where interest rates are going, where the economy is going.
I think the most worrying number out of your survey is building contractor confidence, which, if I read it correctly, is now at a 3-year low. And it suggests surely that the infrastructure promises that are being made by government time and time again are simply not translating into actual work on the ground.
That is very worrying. And this is where structural reform acceleration is important. This is where we see Operation Vulindlela under the GNU being a bit more accelerated. And more importantly as well, if you look at the residential side of things, the interest rate cuts have not been as deep as maybe the consumers would want them to be. From the demand side, mortgage rates are still quite elevated. And then you also look at on the supply side. Contractors have always been finding it difficult in the last couple of years. There's that element of criminality with the construction mafia as well. And this is also reflected in investment. There's a bit of a sluggishness to say, is it really a good environment for us to also put investment and get construction up?
Let me ask you about manufacturing. It the confidence level, I think, remains stuck at 33. So is this exactly the same as construction, that we're facing a structural decline here and that there's a lack of specific policy that might reverse the trend?
I mean, with manufacturing, there's that structural side that is holding it back. The bottlenecks really well known around logistics. But manufacturing is also really hindered by uncertainty. If you don't know anything around the global trade policies that will transpire, you won't increase production not knowing if they will be impacted by tariffs. Locally, if you don't know the policy direction given the period that the survey was done and how all those dynamics were glued together, it was very difficult for manufacturers as well to really say they're going to ramp up production. So manufacturers are really stuck in a place where we don't know much around the external environment. It is slowing down global growth. It's slowing down domestic growth as well. So production does tend to then stall. And you see it in these numbers. They're just expressing what they're seeing out there.
Let me ask you one last question. The report downplaying the VAT controversy as well as previous political tensions over the GNU. And I'm not sure if we should be alarmed or gratified that instability like this is actually being priced in by business.
Yeah, I think at the same time, they did sort of express that because much of the respondents did come in very early. The survey was done between 7 May and 29th. So you do have some respondents who then, prior to budget, everyone was still really on the heels of the fact that you've had two budgets. Its third one should be passing, right? But there was a lot of positives. If you remember the headlines coming out between that period around how the budget process was working, there was inclusion amongst the GNU, there was better cooperation. So it put a lot of people at ease.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. That's Kabetswe Modjapelo, macroeconomist at RMB. I do appreciate your time.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power. you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's billed as the ultimate human race. The 98th Comrades Marathon takes place this Sunday with more than 22,600 runners. But beyond the grit and the glory, the Comrades is also big business. It injects millions into the local economy, it boosts tourism, and puts KwaZulu-Natal, for one day at least, really in the global spotlight. Yet not everyone is running towards the finish line always with enthusiasm. There are always concerns about infrastructure strain, security costs, and I guess whether all communities benefit equally. Joining me now is Prasheen Maharaj, who is president of the Durban Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Prasheen, a very warm welcome, and let's start with that headline number, over 22,000 runners. What is the estimated economic injection this year?
Jeremy, thank you very much for the opportunity. Yes, I think where the economists are predicting in the city, directly about 235 million rand on the Comrades event itself, and then indirect expenditure from transport, accommodation, spending in restaurants, etc., is about 630 million. So, and that also supports during the event about 1,800 jobs.
The challenge, of course, is always to convert those tourism rands into repeat tourism and longer term investment. Is that a little bit more difficult?
Yes. Jeremy, as you know, the Durban economy has been a little bit volatile since COVID-19, because it wasn't just COVID-19, it was the looting and rioting and then the floods. And we're still struggling to get that infrastructure back where we can confidently market ourselves to tourists both locally and globally. So yes, it is a challenge. It's an infrastructure challenge, and we're working very hard with the local government and the assistance of the presidency through the presidential Etkweni working group to get this level of permanency that the tourism industry so desperately needs.
Let's talk a little bit about that infrastructure, and you rightly point to it as a difficulty, particularly around transport and safety. Is there a concern maybe that the marathon itself, the event, is outgrowing what the region can reliably support? Does that worry you?
No. The city itself is a massive city. You know, as I said, I'm in Portugal currently, and the entire country is the size of KZN. And so we don't have a space problem. I think when you look at the level of safety, General Mkhwanazi has been lauded a hero in this province for the way he's tackled the crime. And I think the police, the city police, and other private security guards will take care of that. Where the challenge becomes is infrastructure. So it's roads, it's water and sanitation, it's the electricity. Those are the major concerns, you know, and those largely emanate from two reasons. One's the flooding in 2022, and secondly, the backlog in infrastructure maintenance.
Prasheen, the race, as we know, spans two cities. How coordinated are Durban and Pietermaritzburg in ensuring that local businesses right across the route actually benefit from the influx of visitors?
So I think in terms of the event itself, there's a steering committee and both the cities are involved, and there is good coordination around the event itself. Jeremy, however, the problem I have as an entrepreneur and as the president of the chamber is that I don't think there's enough wider engagement with the business community to ensure that the small and micro businesses benefit from the chamber. Because when I became president, I said we need an entrepreneurial revolution. So that entrepreneurial mindset is not there. And I think that's something we need to work on, because I believe that 600 million rand of GDP created through indirectly can be more than double if more individuals are involved in taking part of the opportunities.
And I think that's an excellent point that you raise. The bulk of the spending obviously then concentrated in hospitality, but not, as you're suggesting, filtering down to township or informal traders. So that entrepreneurial spirit that that you want to create to make sure that there is more of an equitable spread, how do you do that?
So I think for me, I think we mustn't really go with a begging bowl to government as business. That's why we've, with the Durban Chamber, we've just created the Uplift Hub. It's for really, really small businesses, self-employed people really in business. So we want to create all the support mechanisms, but we need the support of the large corporates to come in, not necessarily with money, but as mentors, as creating opportunities on the supply chain, etc. For me, I think supply chain opportunities, Jeremy, are the lowest hanging fruit because there's no money involved. You just need to give the people an opportunity to provide a service.
And Prasheen, do you think there is an appetite among bigger companies to do that?
You know, I met with Anglo-American Zimele, and there's a massive appetite from a company like that. And the few others like FNB have their enterprise development programs. But I think it's few and far in between. I think what we need to do is to get all of corporate South Africa really behind creating an entrepreneurial revolution. Because when one looks at the most successful economies in the world, 70% of the jobs in those economies are created by SMMEs. In fact, Adrian Gore recently said, it's only SMMEs can create the jobs because large corporates can only move as a function of GDP. And you know, our GDP is 1% or something slightly above 1%. So corporates and government is already bloated, can't create the jobs. So the corporates need to understand it's only the supporting SMMEs that we can turbo boost this economy.
Let me just widen the scope slightly and in conclusion, looking at the regional economy perhaps a little bit more broadly, are there lasting legacy benefits from the Comrades Marathon, or do you think it's just a once a year bump that fades very quickly?
I mean, remember, as much as this is a one-day event, I think of the planning that goes into this event. I think for us, it puts Durban on the tourist map. So as much as people come here for that 3 or 4 days or 5 days during Comrades, but the whole world looks at Durban as a possible tourist destination, I think, because of mega events like the Comrades Marathon. And that's the other thing we've been trying to do. We have the Durban Comrades, we have the July Handicap, you know, the Durban July Handicap. Mm. And those are the two mega events in Durban. But I think we need to have 4 or 5, because when I look globally at the tourist meccas in the world, what separates them from people like the cities in Durban is that they have a number of mega events throughout the year. And I think these mega events is what creates the legacy to have tourists 365 days a year. And a city like Durban can, because we have over 300 days of sunshine per year. I think, yes, these things do have a legacy effect.
And Prasheen, given that you're talking to me from Portugal, I take it that you're not running the race on Sunday. We'll forgive you this time, but maybe next year, right?
Yes, I will certainly try, Jeremy. Thank you so much.
All right, that's Prasheen Maharaj, who is president of the Durban Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this Sunday, over 22,000 runners will take on one of the world's toughest ultramarathons. It's the 98th Comrades Marathon. But while they push through nearly 90 kilometers from Pietermaritzburg to Durban, a world-class medical army is on standby. From paramedics to physiotherapists, ambulances to helicopters, something in the region of 580 trained professionals are on the front line. I want to find out what is behind this operation, and I'm in conversation with Mandy Topkin from Netcare, leading the medical charge, and she's going to explain how this life-saving operation unfolds. So 22,000 runners, Mandy, it's a big field. How does Netcare prepare for what I think is essentially a mass casualty rolling event?
Yeah, I think that's exactly. I mean, it's a huge event. It's a mammoth task to try to provide timely care to every runner in need and to reach them. And if you can imagine 22,000 runners with restricted road access, and difficulty to get to them. You're not allowed to go back. If you've got a person 1 kilometer behind you, you can't go back. You've got to get someone from 5 Ks in the other direction. And really what goes into this is every year when we end the comrades, we start planning for the next one. But since 2000, Jeremy, we've been involved as Netcare with the Comrades Marathon, and the healthcare services have really morphed over the years. And I think it's only experience that has taught us that it is an impossible race for healthcare. Mm. It is an impossible service, and we can only do the best we can to provide the care. I mean, we'd love to have an ambulance every kilometer, you know, so that you wouldn't have to look for help. But we've done the best that we can in ensuring that at least there are 8 medical stations where there are qualified nurses from our emergency departments, ambulances on the road, motorbikes on the road, people in the JOC, you know, the Joint Operations Center, that try and piece together all the pieces of information we're getting to find the person that we're looking for. And it really starts at, you know, at the end of last year's race, we start planning this year's race. How much fluid? What's the temperature? How many runners? What are their medical conditions? Are our hospitals ready? So it's really like, I would say, like running a ship and trying to miss the icebergs while you are busy with keeping people happy at the swimming pools, you know.
And so it's Mandy, really the biggest medical risk on the day itself, what would that be, and how difficult is it to prioritize between minor complaints, and I would imagine there are thousands, but also those life-threatening emergencies that you refer to?
Yeah, the biggest medical problems that we have are dehydration, and you know, because of the length of the race, the temperature, so do they get too cold, do they get too hot? Early in the morning we have mishaps, like people running into signs and getting a head injury. Somebody may cross the road, a car, and hit a runner, and sometimes even an ambulance may hit a runner, if you know what I'm saying. It's difficult to navigate between all the people. But I think our biggest issue is people who aren't ready to run and who are really believing that they are ready. And when you have a symptom and you ignore it, so if you go to a medical point and the nursing staff or the doctor say, look, we don't think you should run, and you ignore it, and by the next one somebody's reporting you, and by the third one you're lying on the floor having CPR, you know, that's not what we want to see. We want to see people be responsible with their health. Comrades is just a race. You can finish it, or you'll never finish it if you ignore your healthcare warning signs. Yeah.
What exactly is the protocol if a runner collapses, particularly in one of those remote stretches of the course? How fast can your team realistically respond? Again, given the deployment of the ambulances, which you know, are strategic but sparsely spread.
So, Jeremy, I think what happens towards the end of the race, I think the beginning of the race is quite easy because those runners are prepared. They run it fast. They finish. They're healthy. They have run it before. But towards the end of the race, we start to get the stragglers who probably may not make the gun, you know. And it's difficult to get to them. The most important is to get accurate information. Give us, if there is an official near you, make sure the official is alerted. If you've got a phone on you or somebody sees something, call it in. And then we in the medical JOC try and piece together which is the closest vehicle to the incident that's reported. And we won't necessarily get an ambulance there, but we might be able to get a paramedic to you. Or we might be able to say, you know, to someone, turn them on their side and help us in the meantime. But I think the logistics is the distance, you know, and trying to get to people. And the paramedics are amazing. If we give them a place to go to, they'll go. But they might be stopped by 5 people on the way there who really feel that they need help as well. So you understand, you're not just traveling to one sick person. Between that sick person and you are another 3,000 runners who may want your help as well. So that's the issue. And the ambulance may already have 2 people in it.
Mandy, you speak about accurate information, which is all down to data, I guess. Is there, and given the rise in runners using this so-called wearable tech, I'm wondering if there are plans at some point to integrate real-time health monitoring with emergency services in the future, if that's not already happening?
I think they wear the wearable tech in their families and that can watch what they're doing. So if you've got a particular fruity watch on your arm and somebody else has got your computer, they can see what's happening with your heart rate. But I think we would have too much information. If you try to do it with 22,000 runners in a medical center, it would probably not be it's not impossible. I mean, everything's possible. You know, we just have to ask AI the question of how we do it. I mean, we're already going electronic. Previously, we used to do our records on paper and then have a stack of pile of papers that we'd have to keep for 10 years. Now our medical records are electronic, you know, and the comrades' records are electronic as well. So I think we need to know where you are and what you're seeing. And you know what I would find amazing is that every comrades runner actually has a valid CPR certificate. Wouldn't it be amazing if you collapsed in front of a comrades runner and every single one of them knew how to start CPR? That would be a phenomenal, it's much better than wearables, I must tell you, because that's practical, isn't it? Somebody collapses in front of you and you know what to do, especially if they need CPR. But we try our best and we've done well. And we've battled in some, we always battle towards the end. Towards the end, it's a, but what we do is once a point closes, you know, so if water point one closes, all the medical staff and ambulances then join the back of the race. And so we start managing that. And then when everybody's gone home, we've still got a half a tent full of people who may need to go to hospital, may need fluids, made a family member, is missing, pulled off the race and not let anyone know, or is genuinely missing because they're ill and, you know, walked off confused into the bush kind of thing, and we don't know where they are. So the medical cover under Jeremy Balter, who's the medical director, is a huge undertaking for the safety of comrades. But it doesn't stop a person from dying on the comrades or being seriously injured. We can't predict everything.
It is, as you say, an astonishing exercise in logistics. Mandy Topkin, thank you very much indeed, and good luck for Sunday.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Air travel is bouncing back, at least on the surface. The International Air Transport Association says airline profits are set to grow to around $36 billion this year, fueled by cheaper jet fuel, stronger passenger demand, and high load factors. But is this really a robust recovery or just a fragile margin game built on very thin buffers and vulnerable assumptions? I want to talk to aviation analyst now, Lyndon Burns from Plane Talking, as we dig into the numbers and some of the realities behind them. So, Lyndon, welcome. And airlines are projecting higher profits this year, as I've mentioned, but with around $7 earned per passenger. It's a razor-thin margin, and you'll agree, vulnerable to any kind of minor disruption.
Absolutely, Jeremy. It equates to a 3.7% net margin, that $7.20 per passenger per flight. And that's on profits expected to reach $36 billion this year. But as you pointed out, and as Willie Walsh, who's the head of IATA and who knows a few things about running airlines, as the former head of BA and IAG, as he pointed out, you know, very vulnerable and exposed to global uncertainties, the impact of the tariff and any other trade wars, the conflict still raging in Ukraine and in the Middle East as well. So vulnerable, but this isn't foreign territory, if you like. You know, airlines have had to put up with and contend with these things and uncertainties, you know, since they were, well, going back to the origins of commercial air transport, which was in the closing part of the Second World War, really.
Lyndon, interesting to see that passenger numbers are up. That's a good thing, but revenue is below projection. So I guess it begs the question, would airlines be cutting fares too deeply these days? One, to compete, and two, do you think it's that model is sustainable?
I think what we're seeing is a couple of things. We're seeing more efficiency being extracted in the market. So, you know, the low-cost airlines, the big ones, the Ryanairs, the Southwest, the EasyJets, the Indigos, you know, have shown that it is, you know, what's actually possible and what you can achieve in terms of greater cost efficiencies. And we've all seen, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember, you know, the days when your suitcases and your seat choice, you know, we're included in your airfare, as was the meal and the champagne and everything else. Today, you know, with a few exceptions, you kind of pay for everything these days. I mean, I booked a ticket the other day to fly to East Africa, and If I wanted to have any choice of seat, it was $20. If I wanted a decent seat, it was 50. I think, those things are happening. I think what's really worrying, though, is the situation here in Africa. For a change, we're starting to talk about African Airlines achieving a combined profit this year. It's a very thin one. It's $200 million. And it's a 1.1% net margin and just $1.30 per passenger per flight. But it comes at a time when we're seeing 9% year-on-year increased demand, certainly this year between January and the end of April. And IATA's predicting a 3.7% annual compound growth in passenger numbers for Africa, which will mean a doubling in traffic to 345 million passenger journeys a year by 2043, and will still only account for 2% of the global market. And what was very interesting was they're pointing out some of the obstacles that are in the way here. For example, we're paying a 17% premium on jet fuel in our region, and that's because it's no longer produced locally. It has to be imported and then transported and stored. Our tariffs, taxes, and charges on air transport are between 12 and 15% higher than the global average. Air navigation charges that we pay to the air traffic navigation service are 10% above the global average. The cost of capital, the cost of maintenance and insurance is anything between 6 and 10% above the global average. Right. So, you've got all of those things coming into the mix as well. And I'm not so sure that governments are doing enough to create that enabling environment and to recognize the fact that air travel is not just about carrying wealthy tourists on safari, but it's actually intrinsic to developing your economy and to creating jobs, sustainable jobs across the economy.
And Linda, that enabling environment that you refer to implies a better infrastructure.
It implies better suited infrastructure. So we don't need vanity projects. We need infrastructure that is efficient, both in terms of operations and cost. We need infrastructure that meets today's expectations, both of travelers and in terms of security. So we need digitalized airports, for example, where you can move through that airport quickly and efficiently using your mobile device or a digitalized ID, and at the same time provide very robust security against emerging new threats. And that also helps to signal that you're a competitive, sophisticated economy and therefore a secure and a good and attractive place to invest.
And Lyndon, it would seem that an airport like ORT or even Cape Town International at this point, given the potential trajectory growth that you're referring to, are both very ill-equipped to deal with that increased capacity.
They have the floor space, but there does need to be some CapEx investment there in those facilities and the systems to make those flows work. I mean, for how long have we been seeing things like, the electronic passport e-gates not functioning properly? Or, one moment they're on, the next moment they're not. Even things like travelators, the walking floorways, many of them at our Tambo have not been functioning since they were switched off during the pandemic. And frankly, that's inexcusable because we're all paying airport charges. And in the same way, we're all paying, our air traffic navigation.
Yeah, and there's an expectation.
Well, and we're not getting those. There's an expectation you get, you should get what you pay for.
Just a quick one in conclusion, and I think this is worrying. Cargo revenue dropping nearly 5%, obviously as a result of trade tensions. Do you think we're heading into, or is the industry heading into, a dangerous over-reliance on passenger demand?
So the cargo picture is kind of skewed because a lot of the cargo capacity is generated in the belly holds of passenger planes. So while there's demand for increased passenger capacity, when you add the airline seats, you're automatically adding cargo capacity. And the problem is we're adding capacity faster than we're actually able to fill it. And I think at the moment, on average, certainly in Africa, we're flying with only about 40% of our cargo capacity being utilized. And obviously it reflects, air cargo, because of the nature of the stuff it carries, is high value, low weight, but high volume stuff like cell phones, smartphones, and computer chips and stuff. It's a key barometer of global trade, and it certainly doesn't signal a healthy picture in terms of, you know, of where we're sitting at the moment in the world.
Always good talking to you. That's Lyndon Burns from Plain Talking. I do appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.